So, Lee, I know that your life story did not begin in Australia, so can you tell us how it started?
Okay, I was born in the Netherlands in a place called St. Martin's Brug, which is in English is St. Martin's Bridge. It was a farm, and that was the farmhouse that I was born in. Over there, at that time, most people were born in their home, and there might be a midwife. I think there was a midwife there. I don't know. I don't remember. But, my brother and I were both born in the house there. That's where we were born. Yeah.
So tell us about your family, the children and your mother and father.
I have an older sister and a younger brother. So, and mum and dad.
Over there. Sorry.
There we are. So my father was a farmer, and he was born and raised on the farm. And my mother is the illegitimate daughter of my grandparents. And my grandfather was a Mormon, and his wife wouldn't divorce him. Don't know why. And my grandmother was a widow and very much in love, so they joined and had a partnership. And my mum was born, and in those days you might know that it was a real bad mark to be a child born out of wedlock. Anyway, my father was raised in the Dutch Reformed Church, and he really broke away from their traditions to marry my mum. And my great-grandmother always thought that he was the most marvellous man, that he didn't take into account that sort of thing, that he loved my mum for who she was. Also, when my grandparents eventually did marry, mum was attending a Catholic church, and they asked her whether she would like to take on the name of her father. And she said, no, this has been my name all these years. This is who I am, and that's what it's going to stay as. So, my mother never took on her father's name.
So tell us about the children coming out. Where did you lie in the family?
Well, I'm the middle-aged child. That's me, the small one. And my sister, my oldest sister. I was two when we came here to Australia, just 2.5. My sister was nearly 5. In fact, she might have turned 5 that year because we arrived in May and her birthday's in May. And my brother was just a little bub of 6 months old.
We've moved on. Too far. So you came out to Australia. And
you want to hear about that?
hang on. You lived on share farms in New South Wales and Victoria.
Yes.
And what was the religious background? I mean, you've talked a little bit about it, but what was your family life like as far as religion was concerned?
Okay, as far as religion was concerned, we only went occasionally to church on Sundays. I was raised a Roman Catholic, baptised as such. We actually walked to church, which I don't know how far it was, but we actually walked, and we'd go there to church on Sundays. Later on, when we moved to a different farm, we had a car that we could go to church with, but it was always as whatever. Some of the stories that we had that my mother told me was that the Catholic Church in Australia at the time was very, very traditional, and the priest was the be-all and end-all. And she did tell me this story that when I was still probably about under 5 anyway, that the I suppose it's the equivalent of the elders or whatever came around and asked mum and dad to dedicate and promise to give them £50 to have a car and petrol for the priest. Now, we were very, very poor as share farmers just trying to start off in this world, and my mother said, oh, look, I can't even afford to have a car or petrol for ourselves and we're trying to make ends meet. So, no, we can't do that. Then when we moved to the other farm, and I don't want to sort of give up against the church, but when we moved to the other place, we were going to church, but we were also going to primary, to the local state school, because we couldn't afford for my parents to pay for me to go to school at the Catholic school. And again, the priest came and said, well, if you can't, you know, your children have to come to our school, they can't go to the state school. And Mum said, well, I'm sorry, can't afford it, you know. We haven't got the money for you to pay for them to go to your Catholic school. And he, Mum said, he actually said, or threatened to excommunicate our parents from the church. And Mum said, well, fill your boots. So, you know, my very strong person.
Yes.
That didn't happen.
I think that several other stories you've told me really highlight the fact that she was a very strong woman, and maybe some of those genes have trickled down.
I hope so.
Now, your life on the farm, in the various farming situations you found yourself in, seemed to have been, the life seems to have been rather idyllic for you. Is that how you found it?
I was looking back, it was just wonderful. Even though we didn't have much money, we had plenty. We had horses to ride, we had fish to catch, we had rabbits to shoot and ferret for, and there was just so much in there. And our parents, my parents really gave us so much freedom, absolute freedom. And we had good schooling. There was always enough. And I suppose we were a bit of urchins, really, because Mum insisted on giving us shoes to take to school. We had to wear them to school. But being what we were, we used to go up to the gate where the bus would pick us up, take our shoes off, leave them underneath the milk stand. Anyway, Mum came up there one day and we'd found our shoes. Well, we got into real trouble after that because we just had to wear shoes to school, because we weren't that poor.
And you did love reading through all this time.
Yeah, avid reader. Absolutely loved it. Any book I could get my hands on, I would read. And when I couldn't get hands on a book, and I think this is where my faith journey began, I would read the family Bible, which I happened to bring with me. And it's very old, with the gilt edging and everything like that, and it's got a bit of the family story, parents and grandparents inside it. But I love the stories, and if I couldn't get a book, this is where I'd go, and I'd sit down in the lounge and read it. And I loved all the Old Testament stories, you know, all the blood and guts and everything. It was great.
Now there's a lot more we could talk about from that early life, but there's so much more life to come. I can't linger there, so I'm going to take you on right up until your teenage years, and here's your Deb photos. But when you were about 16, your father came home quite ill at one stage. Would you like to talk about the effect that had on your life?
Yeah, I had a really great life, you know, tennis, squash and everything, as I said before. But then when I was, and I usually occasionally used to go and help Dad down milking in the shed. I should have mentioned that we were dairy farmers and milking. And anyway, Dad went away for a couple of weeks and I was just working in the shed and helping out. But when he came back, he had brucellosis. I don't know if any of you know what it is, but it's a, I think you might call it Q fever in Queensland, but it was worse than that. He was really, really ill. He couldn't bear to look at a cow, let alone smell one, or anything. And my life just turned around suddenly, from being a fun-loving, you know, just having a great time going, just helping Dad whenever I wanted to. I had to turn around and run the farm. Mum was working in Melbourne to make ends meet and to support my sister, who was doing a hairdresser trainee in Melbourne, and so that just left me at home. And my brother wasn't really that helpful. He was still a little bit young, but Yeah, so it ended up being me.
So you seem to have a huge amount of responsibility put upon you at that stage in your life.
Yeah, I think it changed me a lot to suddenly realise that you just can't go through life having it all. I realised how much I loved my dad, and I just took on the responsibility of it. I didn't even really think about it. I just did it. Yeah.
Now, you were thinking yourself, when you were looking to a career, that you might get into the CSIRO, but then your headmaster made a different suggestion. What was that?
He called me at a high school. I was prefect and head prefect, and he was concerned because I think he knew that my parents were not all that wealthy and wouldn't be able to support me going into any career at university or anything like that. I thought CSIRO would help me because they can you can do training with them. But he thought that I would be a very good teacher, and he suggested that I should apply. And I thought that was, after he talked to me about it, I thought that was a good idea because you get a scholarship and you get a wage. And I was accepted, and that's what I ended up doing. I was a teacher for 7-8 years. Yeah.
You did talk about having a speech impediment at that stage in your life, which rather surprised me.
Yeah. You probably just hear it as a slight hesitation now. But
we don't hear it.
But I did. I had quite a distinct stammer, especially anything that had a hard, like a k sound. And I would just end up choking on that sound and have to try and get over it.
Well, yeah. You did manage to, very successfully.
Yeah, I think my husband had a lot to do with that.
Okay. So you taught in Victoria, various schools, primary schools, for about 7 years, and you ended up at Mildura.
Yes.
And we have got a picture of your class there.
That's one of my classes there. But then from there I moved down to another little school at Mildura South, and there it was a 5-teacher school or a 4-teacher school and a principal. Turned out that the principal was an alcoholic, and me being the senior teacher, apart from him, I ended up becoming the principal of the school.
So more responsibility.
But I'll go on there. Teachers there had a... We were fairly tight-knit. We'd go and have our parties and everything. And I was at a party one day, just sitting there and listening and talking and things, and I was listening to them, and they were all starting to talk like the children they teach, even me. And I thought, this is not where I want to be.
So this brought you to a different direction.
There was a rather handsome young captain from the transport corps going as part of recruiting drive going through the town, and I happened to meet him and listen to a talk, and I thought, well, if they've got good looking guys like him in there, that's where I'm going. So I applied.
So
and
this
was accepted.
This got you into your army life, which was a very big part of your life. You were involved in a lot of sport. We've got lots of pictures of your skiing activities. Do you want to talk about that?
I did my training and graduated and ended up... before we got there, I didn't mention this to you. I spent 3 years down in Melbourne posting there. And in 1978... it turned out that I had a medical issue that I wasn't aware of, and it runs in our family. I ended up with fibroids, and they were quite large. And I had an operation to see if they could be removed, but they couldn't be. So I ended up having a hysterectomy. So at 28 years of age, I was no longer able to have children at all.
But you did become engaged to be married at
later,
about this time.
So no, not then. So I went on in my life and ended up at a place called Kapuka, where I was involved in helping instruct there. And the every state has what they call a intersport rally, and there was skiing, and I thought, I'm going to put my name up for that. And it turned out that I was the only girl who could ski reasonably well. They did do some trials, so I ended up being on the team. And because the Air Force heard that the Army was going to put a girl on their team, they ended up getting one for their team as well. But
had to
who
keep
could
up
ski a bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Talk about the engagement.
Okay, I'm going to touch on something that might touch some nerves. Please forgive me if I do. Because I no longer felt like I was a woman, I couldn't have children, and I thought, who could love me? I think it was a little bit too easy and open with my favours, because I wanted to be loved by a man. And I had a number of relationships, and by God's blessing, nothing ever happened to me. I was always well protected. But then I did meet someone who actually asked me to marry him, and I thought, oh, this guy loves me. He knew I couldn't have children. I thought, he really loves me. Yeah. Yeah, so I said, yeah. But he said, well, just keep it a secret for a while. But then when we met again, he went home to his family for the holidays and I went to Mum and Dad, didn't say anything. When we got back together, because we worked in the same area, when we got back together, he said to me that... He couldn't marry me and wanted to break off engagement because he wanted to have children of his own. Well, that broke my heart.
And this probably led to a change in your spiritual experience.
Yeah. I was so hurt by it. And this is my moment where I know God had his hand on me all the time. Where I lived was in the officers' lines or the accommodation, and I was so upset. I just got down on my knees beside my bed and I just wept my heart out. And I said to God, look, I just remember it so well. I'm just so, so sorry. I have been trying to do everything my way, not your way, and I'm just so sorry. You know, I just let you. If you want me to be married, you find the guy for me to be married. I'm not having any more relationships with anyone to try and have somebody love me. It's not going to happen. I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm not going to smoke anymore. I'm going to be very, very. I'm going to look after myself in the way that I conduct my life. And I remember, and I still remember, that flood of warmth and the feeling of God just wrapping his arms around me. It's not able to be explained. It happened. And it was just a full peace that came over me. And I thought, yeah, you know. I did 100. I repented and did a 180-degree turn, and moved on from there. So that was my beginning of my walk with God.
So is this, would you say, where your faith became a personal thing?
Yeah. Mm. Yes, far more personal. Not just going to church. I still went to church on a Sunday occasionally. Went Easter, Christmas, because that's what you do when you're a Catholic. Oops, sorry. Forgive me. Forgive me. But that was what you had to do. Yeah, I had to do that.
Mm. Now, at this point, we've included a photo of a chaplain, Chaplain Denby Holmes. Would you like to talk about how he became involved in your life?
Well, I had an operation on my knee and had to go to physiotherapy where Denby's rooms were. He was the chaplain for the Army in 2nd Military District, and was located in Sydney, and that's where I was at the time. And I used to go over and have to sit in the chair outside the physio's rooms, and Denby would just come out and he'd have a chat to me, chat. And we had a lovely time, and I, just talking to him, and he ended up marrying me.
He married you to somebody. He married you to Sam.
He did too. That's the same way I said to him. A French man was trying to tell him I loved France, but I ended up telling him I loved him. So anyway, no, Denby married Sam and I.
Yes, yeah. So we're jumping ahead a bit, because we all know you as married to Sam, but how did Sam come into your life?
Well, Sam came to visit me when I had that operation, and because he was flying with the New South Wales Rescue, and because he was in the army and I was in the army, we knew each other, but casually, and I think he liked me, and he said, "Oh, look, I come over to there sometimes with patients, and everything." He said, "I'll drop in and say hello." I told him where I was going to be, and he came over and he walked in the room, and he stayed for hours, well past visiting time. And when he walked out, I just thought, I'm going to marry that man. So the story started and finished right there. I married.
So we'll have a look at that wedding.
Yeah.
Tell us something special about that wedding.
Oh, well, what happened was Sam had two boys, which was a blessing from God, from his marriage, previous marriage. And the two boys are there, and the younger one is very intent on watching what's happening there. Do you want to go on to what happened?
The light?
Yeah.
Yes.
You need to go on to the next picture, I think.
Okay. Well,
after you leave the church and you go outside, what we didn't know was that Sam was working with the New South Wales Police Air Force Wing, and known as Polair, and they had been flying overhead waiting for us to come out so that they could put the light on us as we came out. So, you know, the big sun, the big light that they had. And anyway, we were just a little bit late coming out, so they'd been flying over and over and over and over. And Neville Rann was the Premier of New South Wales at the time. He lived in the area. And he rang and he said, "What's going on here?"
Just a wedding.
I don't know what they said, but yeah. And that's us waving up at them. Yeah. I didn't know. I don't think Sam knew either that they were going to do that. It was a lovely surprise.
So you were both officers in the army. What was that like? What was your life like in that regard?
That was interesting, because Sam was a captain. When he came, well, what happened was when we met, Sam was a captain and I was a captain. But then he resigned to go into the police air wing, and I stayed in the military. And he said, "Well, you should be the one that has the career." I said, "Okay, that's fine." So he stayed with the police air wing for 3 years, and I was stayed there. And then I was moved to Canberra and promoted to major. And he said, "Well, I think that I'll resign and I'll go with you." So I was the principal for a while. Where was I going with that one? Doesn't matter.
Well, maybe you can talk. Was it all right, you being the major and he was the captain?
It was...
Major's higher than captain, you know that, don't you?
It was rather interesting, because I'd sort of say, "Hey, Sam." He said, "Yes, ma'am, I'm standing at attention." It was a bit of a joke with us.
Yes.
But he was a lot of fun. We had a really good life, yeah.
Now, you had lots of army experiences, and you sometimes were responsible for 1,000 personnel in your army career.
Oh, yeah, I don't know what happened there. But, yes, before we moved up here to Oakey, I was in Melbourne. This is going to get all over the place, but I was in Melbourne my commanding officer resigned, and rather than he resigned at the beginning or early on in the year, and rather than find someone else to replace him, they decided that I should be the CO, as we used to call it, for the rest of the year. And so I ended up with 1,000 personnel and a multi-million dollar asset to manage, and I just fell into it, and just what I did.
Remember that mother of yours?
I just took on things and did things. And there's a photo of me as the CO. And one in the parade, I had to carry a sword. Never had any sword training at all. So Sam had me in the backyard of our home, and he was giving me sword drill because he had done it. And so he was there teaching me how to, you've got to do this and that, you know. he was a lot of fun. And he was also very strict. No, you don't do it like that. You've got to do this and got to keep it straight and, you know, fingers straight. So I think I've got it right there.
And you're also involved sometimes with training people from Papua New Guinea.
We always had a heart for other people. It goes back to when we're in Melbourne, we attended the Church of Christ. Oh, I should say when Sam and I married, Sam was Church of Christ, and we were going to the Swanson Street Church of Christ of the North, and they were supporting the Asian students from the Melbourne University, and members were invited or encouraged to have them come to their home. So we had Malaysian students that we would foster for a year until whatever and different things, but it gave us a bit of a heart for them. So when the Papuan students were flying, it was just a natural thing. And we had a farm north of Gympie, and we invited a group of them to come up and be on the farm with us. We had a weekend there, and we had a hangi and went fishing down on the river and did all sorts of things. And it was a really lovely, lovely weekend. And it was their last weekend, because the following week they were having their final flying test and then they would be graduating. The very sad thing about it was that after that, so we went back on the Sunday night, Monday, Tuesday they went off on their flying test, and one of the planes crashed and three of them were killed. It was just really, really sad, but it was a wonderful thing that we were able to have that weekend where they could celebrate their culture and be together away from military and just have fun. But it was just so, so sad.
That was probably one of the things that led you to find that prayer became much more important to you?
Yes, that's right. One of the things that happened was that was a major thing that happened out at the Army Aviation Base, and there was another couple of crashes that happened, and there were a few people who were dedicated Christians and, you know, who wanted to pray. So we started up a prayer group with the chaplains. There were one was the chaplain for the base, another one was the everyman who used to go out with the soldiers with lollies and drinks and things and everything. And there was a core group of six, occasionally more. We would get to work an hour early and we would pray for the safety of the base, the safety of the pilots, for the work people, the maintainers, everyone to be vigilant and take care. And then we also prayed for God's covering and protection over everything that would happen. And God answered.
Yes, and I think sometimes people asked you about that, didn't they?
Oh, yes. A lot of military people don't want it to be known that they're Christians. But some of them would come up and ask, say, hey, look, I've got a bit of an issue, you know, blah, blah, blah. Would you mind praying for me? I'd love to do that. So we did that. And there are a lot of closet Christians in the military, because as the saying goes, there are no agnostics or anything else in the when you're under fire, you have to make a choice. You either believe in God or you don't. So yeah, so there are quite a few quiet Christians there.
So you moved around quite a bit with the army, but you ended up at Oakey.
Yeah.
How did your church life develop from there? What churches were you involved in?
Well, all my life it was mostly the Catholic Church and then the Church of Christ. There was something that happened here, and I don't have to repeat it, but because of that, when I ever see anybody standing alone in church or in a group or looking a little bit lost, I will go over and say hello, because what happened to me made me, I would not go in, let anyone else have that same situation happen to them. And so those of you who know Lynn and David Dowling, do you remember David and Lorna Fawcett? David and Lorna and Lynn, they were all in the same home group or life group. They knew what was happening with us, and they decided to pray us into the church, because Sam and I were not going to church at all. And David invited Sam and I to attend their home group. And Sam said, I didn't want to go to the home group. I said, what are they? He said, United in Church. I said, really? Do we want to go to United Church? Oh, come along, we'll go and see what it's like. Oh, okay. So we were made so welcome and just enfolded. And by going to there and learning that there's really nothing to be afraid of, it's all the same. And we started coming to the High Street church then. And met Cole Warren. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, so you became a bit interested in deliverance ministry before this, but this probably opened it up to you much more, meeting Cole.
Yeah. Cole, we were having issues with our younger son and things that had been happening. And Cole had given a talk in a sermon in church, and I had asked, said to Sam, I think we should go and have a chat with Cole about what's happening and see if he can help us. So I rang him, and he said to me, come over now. And this was on a Sunday afternoon, straight after lunch. So we went over, and he invited us in. He said, I'm just waiting for another person. And I thought, why would he be waiting for another person? We just want to talk to him. And he said, I'm waiting for Marion. Now, I don't know, Marion moved down to Newcastle, so I don't know where she's now, but I do remember her name, beautiful blonde-haired lady, older lady, and we went straight into full-blown ministry as a husband and wife, which Cole said he never did, and out of that, we had so much freedom, and we just grew and grew and grew, hungry for the word.
Mm. You left the army. You did some more farming in Gympie. You finally ended up in Toowoomba.
Yeah.
What were your church experiences here? Because it wasn't just Rangeville.
No, we moved into a house and which we were renting. Sam was a major at this time and I was just a civvy. So I was saying, yes, sir. But anyway, we had people who were living over the backyard from us, and we heard them playing as the deer pants for the water, and their daughters came and looked over the fence to see who we were. And so Dad came out and said, well, who is this guy that my daughters are talking to? And they started to have a bit of a yarn. And anyway, they said, why don't you... Do you attend a church yet? No, we haven't found one yet. Well, would you like to come to our church? What church is that? Lutheran Church. Oh. Well, we thought it was a bit rude to say no, so off we went to the Lutheran Church and really found it quite good. Blessing from that was my parents came to live with me, who had denied anything to do with Catholic, And because they were Lutheran is very close to Catholic in many ways, Mum came out one morning and said, I think we might come to church with you. Well, you know, that was the beginning of a lovely time that they had reconciled with their God. They were going to church, hearing the word, and when they died, they were with the Lord, and I know that's where they'll be when I see them, so, yeah.
When I watch you and Sam now, you both seem to be very much involved in helping ministries. How did that become a focus in your life?
I don't know. It just did. It's just something we do.
Yes. Yeah. I know that Sam finds cars for people and you're always having people home for hospitality and lots of helping issues.
Yeah.
I've now got some pictures of you as a tomboy, which I thought I couldn't really leave out. You loved motorbike riding, so we've now got a few pictures of that.
Yeah. I had left the army and I was a civilian now, and I think I just needed the thrill. But one of the things that Sam I used to go riding on the back of the bike with Sam, and I'd be sitting there as pillion, and he'd be riding along and I'd be there going, oh, next thing, clunk, I would fall asleep. And he'd be there, you know, saying, wake up, dear. And one day we were out there with a group riding. There's a lady in front of me who was about 20 years younger, and she was riding this little bike, and I thought, well, she can ride a bike. I can ride a bike. So I went and got my license, and then Q ride came in, so I could get onto a bigger bike, and that's it. That's my Harley Davidson Juice, just under 2,000 cc.
It's a wonder you could hold it up.
She
won a prize.
Well,
for the
I
bike.
Was a strong little thing, and I ended up winning a prize. For my bike, yeah.
But I'm also going to show some pictures of Katie. Would you like to tell us about how she came into your life?
Well, this is another one. You might remember with the group that we used to pray at the base, there's a lady there who was having some difficulty with her children. And she said, would you mind having a bit of a chat to Katie? And I said, no, I'd love to meet her. I met Katie, and she was just the most beautiful little teenage girl, feisty, but just gorgeous. And so she and I became friends, and her sister became friends with us, and her brother. And then from there, we've just got a lot of, from not having any kids in my life at all, I have heaps of them now, one way or the other.
Mm. Yeah. Now, I'm going to put up some things that you said to me while we were spending quite a few hours together talking about these things, and I'll just give people a chance to read them. I know you say that everything in your life has been a preparation for your present situation. Would you like to elaborate on that?
I think many of you could relate to this. When you look back over your life, at the time you had, and my life was not a dream. I did have some really tough times and hard times. But in it all, God is with you, and he is preparing you for things that are going to happen in the future. And I've always found that he had his hand upon me. I might not have thought it at the time, but looking back, he did. And so I think everything that happens prepares you for what he wants you to be as you grow.
Thank you very much, Lee, for sharing your life with us. I know you sense God's hand has been on you. You are certainly blessed to be a blessing, and you live that out daily. Yeah. Thank you.
May I, first of all, I'd like to bless all of you too. I hope you are encouraged by what I've said. Shared. If you want to talk to me about anything again, but most of all, God is a forgiving and loving God, and when you come to him in truth, like he did when I got down on my knees, he really you really know that, yes, you are loved, very much loved by our Lord God Almighty. God bless you too. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions for Lee right now?
Any questions?
Any questions for Lee?
Did you know Reverend Rod Clifford out of Okeyami Aviation? He was the chaplain.
I think he was later after I left. I left the aviation centre at the beginning of 95.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think he came after that. I can't even remember the name of the guy that was there. But the everyman, he was just delightful. He moved up to Darwin. He was Salvation Army. Little man, his wife was enormous. Just a lovely, lovely people. Very much in love with the Lord. Yeah. I'm happy to talk about anything.
Maybe you'd like to speak with Lee later, and that would be fine.
I just have one memory, like, that stands out from when you were up in High Street that has sort of come up.
My boys were young. Ginny was 3 when we went to Rangeville, so I don't know what time period that was. He's 40 now. But you guys had the coolest car that our boys were just... Oh, it was a Unos, yeah. A little red. And then they used to come on their bikes. They had one each, didn't you?
Yes.
Harleys.
Yeah.
But I remember, you know, my boys thinking how cool this couple were. And they just could relate to them, you know, and because my boys were into cars, so, you know, and Sam's still into cars, and they're still into cars. But... yeah, just memories like that that I can remember of their time in High Street. Yeah.
Ever since I've known Sam, he says, "This is my last car." And everyone who's around me, I say, "Did you hear that? Did you hear that? You are the witnesses. This is his last car."
Famous
last words. Yeah. I know I was going to say, there are no agnostics in the trenches. Trenches was the word I was looking for.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
That's it. Thank you, everybody, for your patience.
Thanks, ladies. There we go.
Thank
motorbike
you.
Riding, rabbit shooting. Thanks, Lee. Thanks, Yvonne. That was really great. We thank you that you're back in the fold here. It's ministry. And they do. You see them go out and give somebody a hug or put their arm around someone. You've just got a really welcoming both ways.